as the generic Pedagodzilla on Tour music fades away. I'm here, Mark, at the end of the first day of the Riddle HE conference, sitting around in the canteen waiting for the dinner to start and introducing the first day resume. So over the course of today, I've chatted to 7 different people, and I will be bringing all those together into one Pedagodzilla on Tour episode with a little bit of that generic linking music in between the chats that I've been having. It's been a good day. I could do a Mike Collins style recap of the whole day, but I think I'll just let the 7 interviewees speak for themselves, really, and I'll rejoin you for tomorrow. So, this is the very first episode recording of the conference, and I'm talking to the keynote speaker who kicked us off with the whole conference this morning, Nashua Ismail. Now, do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Thanks, Peter. It's really great to be the keynote speaker and attend the conference and see all my colleagues from previous work. My name is Nashua. My area of expertise is about education technology. So, and that started about 15 years ago. As a teacher, as a practitioner, I was wondering what happened when you press a button and you would like to learn.
Yeah.
Where does learning go? Did it happen or not? How you know that you learned?
Yeah. So that's really interesting. So Nashua and I worked together at Durham University and started to try and get a few projects off the ground back then. But then you moved to Liverpool.
Correct. Right, yeah. Yes.
And what's your role there?
Well, I was lecturer in education technology in a center that informed the other teams. So we were directorate of education. So our contact was not with the students, but with the academics. Sure. Again, that when they are using technology, how to find learning. And because the department was part of the HLS or Health and Life Science. So most of the academics were from health nature, health background, physicians, doctors, nurses, even the paramedics. Yeah, so again, it was education technology in what does it do when you would like to teach? Now I'm in Imperial College in London. I'm working in a project about generative AI now.
Okay.
And that is the plan is to develop a chatbot. A chatbot will help academics to give a feedback. But we are still in the early start because we would like to build up the project with lots of perceptions, views from the students, from the teachers, first about the feedback. Because we found that feedback literacy can direct how you perceive the feedback.
Mm-hmm.
So, and how you define feedback. Is a feedback for the students, is it, are they mark-driven? Or for them, it's just a point and we lead them to another point in their learning journey. This is a big difference between the two concepts. Yeah, so this is what we're doing now. We're looking at the feedback and if the Gen AI has an opportunity to improve it and mainly reduce the workload for the staff.
That's always important.
Exactly.
But does that also mean that the students, if there's something the student wants to follow up with the feedback, they can then go back to the Gen AI and go, well, what do you mean by? And then you can monitor that sort of process.
Exactly. And this is interesting because when we ask the students, it's lots of interviews and focus groups. When we ask them, do you use Gen AI in learning? They say, yes, we use it very few, in very few uses. And then when we ask with more in depth, we found actually they use it to get the feedback. So sometimes they use it, but they are not really sure in what aspect, what extent, and what use for it.
Sure. So it's also developing the feedback literacy as
correct.
Well by explaining this is means about this and
exactly.
so on.
Exactly. Yeah. Some students, for example, when they say, what is the feedback, how you feel about like a harsh feedback?
Mm.
Some of them, they found it demoralizing. The others, they found that it's good for the learning because if it's constructive and even it's harsh, it will help them to improve it will show them what to do next. So it is useful and they like it that way. Sure. So it's between like and dislike for the same statement.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Well, also, Andrew, if you just turn around now, you can see Andrew. I don't know if you know him.
Yeah, he's
He's done some really interesting work on the tone of feedback. And he used to do a lot of stuff on spoken feedback. Because when you got... Sometimes students will read what you intend to be not necessarily harsh feedback, but they will read it in a tone which kind of implies that actually they've read it way more harshly than it is.
Oh, okay.
And that students are way more accommodating to spoken feedback.
Yes.
Because you can be gentler in the way that you phrase it. You can actually use a gentler tone of voice.
Yeah.
And that conveys, that takes out some of that harshness that they might actually feel about that feedback.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, even if you can get, because AI voices are amazing as well, aren't they? So if
really
you can get
great,
them to say, you can program them to say it in a really nice, accommodating way.
Yeah, exactly. And
soothing voice.
Yeah, maybe I'll have a chat with Andrew, maybe.
Yeah,
that's
sure,
interesting.
Yeah.
And another aspect that, because we interview both teachers and students, we found that sometimes the teacher, they're talking about a feedback type. For example, group feedback.
Mm-hmm.
And they found that they praise this method and they say it's really great, it worked well for the students, while for the students, when they ask about the same type, they say, no, it didn't work.
Oh,
we didn't
really?
Like it. I didn't find it personalizing for me.
Yeah.
The time was not enough to ask the questions I want. So it's really great that there should be a meeting point between the teachers and students. And if there is a type of the feedback, it's not one size fits all.
Yeah. And also, I guess there's frequency of it as well.
Exactly.
So some people just care about the mark and other people need guidance all the way through. And
yeah, totally. That's very obvious. Yes. Yeah, some students, when we ask them, when you hear the word feedback, what comes to your mind? Some of them, my mark, how much I get.
Yeah.
So it's how many grades I missed.
Mm-hmm.
So for them, this is a very mark-driven team.
Sure.
Others, they say, what guidance for what I'm going to do next. So here we're talking about qualitatively about the learning journey.
Yeah.
So these are two students. Both of them, they would like to get their qualification. They learn.
Mm-hmm.
So how us as tutors to reach these two diversity of ideas.
And also, if you're thinking about feed forward, that is also going to be different for what they're doing next in a way. So you can actually use this to tailor the feedback more appropriately for those sorts of pathways as well, I guess.
Yes, exactly. But what I noticed also, when I ask the students, when you receive a feedback which is vague or you didn't understand or you need to follow up, what do you do? Few of them who do a follow-up, for different reasons.
Yeah.
A, when they receive the feedback, if it's toward the end, why I'm bothered? It's end, I'm going to go to next to year two. B, when the teacher is not accessible because they are busy or they have less frequency meeting them. Three, it's a personal perception. Sometimes the students are shy or they're more introvert or they prefer to talk to their colleagues. So sometimes the student, they say, we have questions about the feedback, but they don't work on it.
Yeah.
So all
of those things, hopefully, this will.
Yeah, this is so far we didn't finish the data collection, but these are some of the reasons the students why they don't do a follow up or the feedback. It's like you have a question and you don't work on it to find an answer.
So let's move on to the conference.
Yep.
How are you finding the conference? Enjoying it?
Yeah, it's really amazing. First of all, of course, I met the team that we worked before. And it was easy. You know that with the conference, about the venue, about the logistics, about how to get into the room, you know, all of this. And I think it's really, really well organized. So I really like it. We're still in the beginning. I attended just one, which was really one session, which was really great. I'm really looking forward. So I highlighted what I need to attend. I prefer more the workshop style.
Sure. So what are you looking forward to?
I will go for about decision making and the next session, in room 18, because it's something also it's interest me. You know, sometimes you would like, you have a topic in head and it's really great to find people work on it. So it's about how to make informed decision about the choice. I'm more with about tutors, academic educators, what are the tools, how they think, because I think there are lots of work needed to be done, especially with the technology and generative AI, about tutors' perception and their application of technology.
So a lot of the themes of this conference then are exactly what you're...
Exactly. To be honest, sometimes I struggle when there are parallel sessions, mm-hmm. because which one really I like to attend both. So, yeah, I try to make a judgment for this.
I might miss a few if I'm podcasting, but we'll see.
You miss a lot.
But then I get to chat to people, so it will compensate.
Yeah. But it's really great also because it's going to be recorded. So even what I miss, I think I will be able to catch up what I miss.
Yeah. Oh, that's excellent. Also for the people online.
I think there are opportunities to catch up what you've missed. So I really like it because there are lots of things. And even within each single session, there's something you learn. There are links you can follow up. Mm-hmm. And there is a network as well. And it's great that the diversity of minds, people asking different questions from different perceptions. So it's really enriching to sit in the room and listen to people's talk.
Brilliant. Mm. Okay, well, thanks, Nashua.
Thank you very much,
Peter. Hopefully chat again.
Yes, okay. Please. Right, thank you very much.
Lunch.
Oh, yeah. I'm starving. Thank you.
Okay, bye.
So meet you there.
Yeah. Now, my second chat of the morning, or is it into the afternoon now, is with Andrew Middleton. And hopefully we'll keep this to 10 minutes because I've known Andrew for 15 years.
Quite a long time, I guess, Mark.
So there's quite a lot of stuff to catch up on.
Yeah, but it's interesting whenever we do get together, which is infrequent. Mm. And actually thinking about my session today, I'm delighted to have a pre-conversation with you because my own session will be almost like stepping stones through a similar trajectory. So, we've known each other for a while. You were looking at immersive worlds and I was looking at audio feedback.
Yeah, and I've already mentioned audio feedback to Nashua this morning because I know that you sort of were really heavily into that and finding out lots of interesting things. So take us through the stepping stones then. What are the stepping stones that you're going to be talking about in your session?
So essentially my session is called Reimagining Learning. I can't remember what it's called, but it's playing with paradox and ambiguity. So I think there is still a desperate and indeed urgent need to really rethink and reimagine what teaching and learning is in higher education. And I think those people who have been associated with digital learning technology, enhanced learning, or whatever we used to call it over all these years, have always felt as though there's something to do with a significant shift in the way we think and relate to each other as teachers and learners and that sort of thing. That's my constancy, because I don't really see a significant impact from this whole digital thing. I think, you know, it's there on the table as something of an answer to the massification of higher education following the Deering Report at the end of the 90s. Mm. And, hey, technology came to explain how we were going to do this scaling up. We scaled up, but we didn't imagine. We didn't innovate, I would say.
We didn't innovate with learning and teaching.
We've had lovely little eddies of wonderful digital activities and research and so forth. I'm looking and wondering about, so what? What actually has that changed in terms of how we understand education?
Okay, so, and was this, some of this prompted by the lockdowns and pandemic? Is this a sort of caused a reevaluation of some of this sort of stuff?
It certainly has, Mark.
Sorry, very leading question there.
Well, it certainly has. I've been involved in a QA. I don't think you know about this, so that was a good guess.
Okay.
But
yeah,
inevitably, that's got to be the question, isn't it? I've been involved in this QAA project, Collaborative Enhancement Project, on harnessing multimodalities. And actually, when I set about writing the paper and the session, I wasn't thinking about that at the forefront of my mind. But, you know, this is the point of this stepping stone thing. All of these things that one has done over the years, you know, there's a consistent narrative there somehow. The research that I did in that harnessing multimodalities work focused on spatial fluency.
Right.
Our fluency as individuals, academics and students, to navigate and negotiate and project our own stories onto the learning experience. Essentially what that boiled down to was I interviewed a lot of academics and a lot of students and asked them to tell me how their day had been. So I used photo voice and I used learning diaries and little things like that to prompt discussions. And from those discussions, I really learned a lot, probably that we might not be surprised by, but we shouldn't ignore and we shouldn't move on from. Many of us in the pandemic learned a lot about ourselves and what was important to us. And I think a lot of the findings from that research come back to autonomy in a way and intrigue me.
Yeah. So what specific things then came out of talking to people about their days? Are there any sort of particular examples or cases that really struck home or were revelations for you?
I think the key one is that everyone came out of that episode and everything around it. I mean, it's not just the pandemic. It's who we've become, who universities have become. But the pandemic was a great moment for us to reflect on who we are, what we do, and what we want and expect from our educations and the way we teach. And I think, you know, to really crudely sum up some of the key messages was, you know, during the pandemic, there was a lot of discussion about working from home and online and hybrid learning and fairly technically presented things. Actually, with a breath of relief following all of that, you know, by the time I got to ask people about it, the key takeaway was I can use technology. I do use technology in my everyday life. The everyday life isn't a distinct thing. It is just part of what we do as educated people, educators, learners, whoever we are in higher education. We have lost any demarcation. I think that was one of many overriding remarks. You know, of course, everyone told their different story. That really came through this work as well. We are all really, really different. In fact, how we respond to problems, how we respond to interests, how we respond to knowledge and opportunity, we are all very, very different. And so higher education definitely doesn't want to ignore ideas like diversity.
Yeah. And also expand the ideas of what diversity is, I guess, because I think I wouldn't say we've made progress, but there are visible things like, you know, ethnicities, like genders, like disabilities that we acknowledge and represent, even if we're not working enough towards them. But those differences that you've just spoken about, which is work-life balance, which is the bleed between different aspects of our lives and all those sorts of things, I guess that's something else that you're talking about that we need to be cognizant of?
Yeah, absolutely. As you said, we're pretty much on top of many of those other agenda. Out of this telling of stories, the notion of diversity really amplified the advantage we have of being diverse people. We will approach a question in a different way because our backgrounds, where we come from, where we think we're going, you know, we're all on those, to use the cliche, different journeys, and we could be using that to our advantage, you know, in the classroom, to put it crudely. But we don't seem to appreciate diversity in other than as a problem we ought to be on top
point.
Of. So it's a massive advantage for, you know, as I may have mentioned, you know, my interest is active learning, which is a very ambiguous sort of territory. But voices, taking us back to audio feedback, taking us back to audio in higher education, the different things we say, the different things we feel, the different perspectives, interests, directions that come out through conversation is wildly overlooked. And you know, that again is that constant idea of diversity that's always been there for me.
And Are you getting to explore those ideas in this conference? Is that something that's emerging already?
Yeah, I am, and my session is coming up very shortly. And yeah. I've been told, I mean, this conference is great, and I'm so delighted to see people who I've known for many years. But like you, we only bump into each other occasionally. Several people have told me they're coming to my session, so I'm absolutely intimidated by that. But I know they're the right people. Yeah. And I'm looking for someone to say, Andrew, yeah, we must do something about this.
Well, that's what I got from Nick's introduction, is this isn't just a conference. This is the kickoff of a community of digital learning people, researchers in digital learning, who could then go on to connect more and work more and collaborate on other stuff. So that's an exciting opportunity as well, I guess.
Yeah, and I've mentioned the QAA project we had. Myself and Sam Elkington are really trying to build upon that now. And I will, if I remember, be asking if anyone else is interested in joining the next phase of this.
I think a lot of people would be. It'd be great to work with Sam again as well.
Oh, he's great. Yeah. Really good.
Yeah. Okay, thanks. Oh, and also, just a quick thing, listen to Andrew's podcast, Exquisite Education.
It is. Thank you, Mark. Yeah, indeed. A conversation between like or unlike minded people. Yeah, thank you.
Be really good. Okay, thank you, Andrew.
Thank you, Mark.
Good luck with the session. Now, third chat of the day, and I promise I'm not only going to talk to people I know really well in these sessions, but I've got Chris and I've got Jane, and they are experienced podcasters with their copyright literacy, Copyright Waffle.
Absolutely.
And we've had them on my podcast and all that sort of stuff. But today we are talking about their presentations, and they're doing, Jane's done one already.
I have this morning,
and then
yes.
And about to do another one in about 10 minutes.
It's actually later this afternoon. Oh, okay. It's the last parallel session of today.
Oh, okay. So to kick off, shall we talk about your session that you've just done? What that was about and how it went?
Yeah, so I was just talking about some research I did about 18 months ago into staff digital literacies and open educational practices. So I was looking at staff who come on the PG Cert that we offer, or the MA in academic practice, and take some of the modules I do, and then what impact that might have had on their understanding of digital literacy, of open educational practice, what it is that might have changed. We also compared some of our data to data I'd collected before the pandemic. So we asked, like, a kind of reflect on whether that had any impact on, you know, their confidence around using digital technology. And, yeah, I had some great discussions with people in the room about,
it's really active,
you know, what they thought to kind of these ideas of, is it a kind of continuum where people develop digital literacies and eventually reach this kind of pinnacle of recognizing, you know, what they do and don't know, and that it's something to keep working on? Or was there some people who maybe are just the kind of, you know, didn't even feature in my data because they wouldn't have come on a module about technology.
Yeah, because it was a self-selected sample. But then, of course, that's where you have to start with these sorts of things, really, to try and build up a typology of kind of a captive audience.
Yeah.
I also have missed out my first question, which is, could you tell us who you are and where you'll work and all that? Sorry, just not everybody knows Jane Secker.
I think everybody.
But probably they do,
You actually didn't even say I was Jane Secker. You just said I was Jane.
Oh, this is true. So, yes.
So it's just Jane.
Just Jane.
Yeah. Jane Secker.
City St. George's.
Yes.
And what do you do there? City St. George's.
I can't even say that. I can't speak now.
Yeah.
I am Associate Professor in Educational Development, and I am the Programme Director of our MA in Academic Practice.
And this is about two particular modules that you've had staff on to improve their digital literacy or explore digital literacy.
I have to say as well, I seem to be spending a huge amount of time, like many people are, I think, in the field, dealing with generative AI and various working groups, running workshops. And I think it's really interesting to reflect on what I found about digital literacy and whether any of that is helpful when we approach how we are teaching staff about generative AI and, you know, what it is that we want them to sort of take from that. Like, you know, is it that we're training them and we're trying to upskill them so that they understand more about these tools and can kind of functionally use them? Or is it how we develop that more kind of critical awareness and the sort of ethical reasoning that they need before they even start using them?
And I guess to some extent the panic around generative AI is useful for digital literacy because it draws people in and it's sort of like a Trojan horse, whatever.
Could be a Trojan mouse.
Well, that was a term we used way back in the 2000s or something because it was like the Trojan mouse was everybody wants to do digital learning. While we've got them to think about digital learning, let's get them to think about learning.
Yes.
And often that was the first time they'd really reappraised modules was because they suddenly were trying to put them online and they'd never thought about structuring
and
the learning.
And I think generative AI has done that with assessment, hasn't it?
Absolutely.
Oh, help. My assessment is really, you know, ripe for being kind of, you know, completed by ChatGPT.
Yeah.
So suddenly I've got to think about, actually, what is an authentic assessment in the field I teach? And what is it at the end of the module I wanted them to actually go away being able to do?
Yeah, and if if AI can do it, then why am I educating my students to do this when a computer system could just do it in 10 minutes?
Yeah.
So, or 10 seconds rather. So,
So it's kind of got really to, like, the heart of what on earth we're even doing, isn't it?
What's the point of us? You know, what? And it's leaning into the more human things, really, I think,
is the
answer to that.
It is.
And it's often the people that have thought about assessment and got assessments sorted who aren't actually troubled so much about AI because their assessments can't be done by AI.
No. But then you've also got that whole category of people that are just literally like, can't we just switch this off? Can't you just, you know, put the students back into an exam room where they can't use the technology and
put AI back in the box.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you can't.
Yeah. It's a really challenging time, though. And I think it is actually, I just think with years and years of research that we've done into, you know, how people use technology for learning and what digital skills they need and what kind of other kind of critical thinking skills they need. Like, AI is just like pressing all those buttons, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it kind of makes me just want to go back and sort of say, well, hang on a minute, let's not reinvent the wheel here. There's been loads of people doing work in this area for a really long time. None of the questions are really that new.
Yeah. We had the same...
We had the same with the internet.
We had the same when calculators came in the 70s.
Well, almost. Yeah.
Anyway, Chris has been extraordinarily quiet for the last 5 minutes. I've never heard you not say anything for five.
I've been listening.
Oh, that was me knocking my coffee over.
I've been listening. I've been
learning. Absolutely.
So processing.
We're trying to not fall into some smash and nicey mode here when I'm talking to Chris. So, absolutely, Chris, do you want to tell us who you are? What brings you to the conference?
I'm Chris Morrison. Yeah. I'm the head of copyright and licensing at the Bodleian Libraries, which is at the University of Oxford. And Jane and I, as you mentioned at the outset, we're working together on copyright literacy initiatives for some time, including our podcast, creating games, educational resources, etc. And we're here to talk about our research into copyright anxiety that we've been doing with a Canadian colleague, Amanda Wackerook, looking at copyright anxiety in the UK and Canada. And there is a very strong link here in technology and AI, which is one of the things we're going to be focusing on in our session.
And OER, which Jane was talking about.
OER as well, absolutely.
So give us a quick trail then for the session you're doing this afternoon. What's going to be covered in that? What sort of things are you going to touch on there?
Well, it's a workshop in which we are going to present some findings of our research, but we're also going to be getting participants to contribute their thoughts. We're going to be doing some playful things. Jane's gesturing at me, which giving the game which you can't... I was going to leave it as a surprise, but of course, the people who are listening to this, it'll already have happened. But they may come to one of our sessions on another occasion. Needless to say, people will have to have good aim and the ability to scrabble around on the floor picking things up when they don't quite get their angle.
Oh, this is going to go live in as soon as
these
we finish.
Are essential okay. skills, though, when you're absolutely. Dealing with copyright.
Yes. Are they?
Agility.
Yes.
Skill, you know, sort of attention to detail.
Sleight of hand.
Sleight yes. of hand, yes. yes.
Good pensmanship or penspersonship, if that's even a word.
As long as people don't know, you can get away with it. sorry, that's possibly the wrong approach to copyright.
Yeah. There's a whole load of stuff around what actually, how people conceptualise this.
Yeah.
We have a model that we've come up with, which is what copyright anxiety is a thing. That's what we found.
Mm.
And why does it exist? Well, there are three kind of contributing factors. You've got the law itself, the way it works, the ideologies of it. Then you've got institutions, their policies, which is the topic here about how we deal with using technology. And then there's the knowledge and skills, so basically the practices of people. And a lot of it is that sort of folklore. What can you get away with? What should you do? Nudge, nudge, wink, wink.
Mm.
And what we find is there is an issue here that these things are not aligned properly. And a lot of it does come down to power structures. We think about it, and thinking about it from Jane's presentation, what she was talking about, individual skills. People want to improve their skills, but then you've got this backdrop where it's very different experiences for people depending on where they sit within the hierarchy within the organization. And we find particularly that librarians bear the brunt of the anxiety around copyright because they're expected to provide answers. And in fact, it's a system that doesn't work very well.
Yeah. And it depends so much, and it's blurred and all those things.
And they don't have the authority or the empowerment to kind of fully explain what it depends on.
Yeah.
And that's part of the issue.
Mm.
So, briefly then, because we've nearly run out of our 10 minutes slot, what do you think of the conference? How are you feeling about the conference? Any feedback about it so far?
I think it's great so far.
Yeah, it's nice, actually. It's nice to go to something where you don't have to spend hours choosing between parallel sessions because, you know, there's fewer people, but actually there's lots of really interesting people to have conversations with in more depth. And I think, like, a big conference is great, but actually a smaller conference...
I find networking at something this size so much easier than something that's a lot bigger.
Yeah.
Because you end up talking to people you wouldn't talk to normally, although I haven't done that yet. But then you can actually probably get to chat to everybody at some point.
Yeah, I think so.
Only 40 people.
Yeah.
So it's a really nice feel to it, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
Bruce, feel the same?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Enjoyed the lunch.
Vegetarian.
Nice lunch.
Just to say the principles that Nick set out at the beginning, all of those resonated with me. I think those are really good. So I think it's got a good value system.
Yeah. We're big fans of playful learning and that whole community that they built there. So it's I think, you know, it's the first one, but I think this could grow into something.
Oh, I hope so.
I mean, it is vital. It's vital that we actually have research in digital learning.
You know,
it's kind of, you know, the fact that people are always wanting to know more about, well, how should I be doing this? You know, we've got to go beyond just like giving them tips and tricks for running a Zoom session. You know, we actually just need some empirical evidence of what works and what doesn't. And
a community that's inclusive so that you get all those other voices, because you need to hear those voices in order to make sure that what you're providing hits the spot for everyone.
Yeah.
Need to stop there because people are going into the session.
Time's up.
Right then, well, thank you very much.
Lovely to
speak to you.
Yeah, lovely to catch up with you, Mark. Thank you.
Right,
bye,
then,
Smashy.
Okay.
Bye, Nicey.
Thank you very much, Jane.
Backman Turner Overdrive.
Right, so we're into the fifth recording now, and it's the first one I'm having with somebody I've not met before, which is great, because otherwise it looks really incestuous and it's just like, oh, Mark only talks to the people he knows. So you'll have to introduce yourself to me and to the listeners, who you are, where you're from, and what you do.
Yeah, sure. Hello, everyone. My name's Neil Dixon. I work at Anglia Ruskin University. I work as an academic developer in digital learning.
And why are you here then? What's brought you up? Is it because you know Alex and Alex has dragged you up?
Or? Yeah, I actually discovered it before Alex. Okay. Alex did send it to me. I mean, naturally, he'd be probably not doing his job if he didn't.
Yeah.
But I can't remember how I come across it, but it must have been on a mailing list or something.
Mm.
And then because I work in digital learning, I thought it was a natural fit really, and. I teach an online module as well. I thought it was a really good idea for a conference. I like the idea of the playful approach and the active approach, which I didn't actually realize because I submitted a session, but I didn't sort of, when I first looked at it, it wasn't obvious. But then when I looked at the presenter guidelines, that was in there. But So yeah, I thought, oh well, this is actually quite good.
Yeah,
I just saw research in digital learning, and it was like, right, that's my job. I need to go, otherwise, I need to meet other people who are doing this sort of thing.
Because Nick and Alex both started off the Playful Learning Conference, and Nick's a professor of Playful Learning and Digital Learning, I think. So it was, I hadn't clicked because I just thought, oh, research. Digital learning, and of course I hadn't clicked Nick's running it, so of course it will also have all the playfulness to it as well, which I just feel really comfortable with and all that sort of thing. How are you finding it? How's the conference been so far? I know we're only still just in the afternoon of the first day, but interesting things, useful things,
confusing things. Yeah, it's quite diverse, isn't it? It's quite a diverse range of sessions. So my favourite so far is Jane Secker's session about digital scholarship. Can't remember what the rest of the title was, but I think it was just the discussion in that, because it was quite a, is this a useful term? Yeah, so basically open resources, open publishing, digital scholarship, and there was a really good discussion going on in the room, and I like it when you kind of get that sort of bit of a debate going on.
Yeah.
It wasn't just a kind of, we need to do this. It was a bit of a sort of a to and fro, really, and it's good to get different people's perspectives.
Yeah,
and it was throughout the whole room as well. So obviously Jane's got a good rapport with a lot of the people in the room. So it was quite a good, an interesting insight, I suppose.
Yeah.
Actually, I didn't really know anything about the area. I don't know if you were at that session or not.
I was, yeah. I found it really interesting because it was about, I think, because I'm in academic development, and it was talking about different academics' approaches to digital learning and things like that, and about how some are not really feel themselves to be digitally literate, and some of them aren't and don't care. Well, not don't care, but they do enough, and that's okay for them. So for me, it was interesting from that perspective. Yeah. Definitely. So, and is there anything you're looking forward to particularly? Well, tell us more about your session then.
Yeah, I've been doing a session tomorrow. I'm looking forward to the session about Banford. We are at Banford now as well. That's tomorrow as well. So that's probably one of the most looking forward to, apart from my own. But I've got a session tomorrow, 1:30. I'm running a fiction writing workshop. So people are going to be writing a short fiction story. And it's the cloak is technology, about thinking about technology and the future. Trying to think about technology beyond the current narratives.
Right.
So just thinking, okay, well, if you take a technology that doesn't exist at all, what does it look like? Rather than thinking about the practical implications. So it's quite a good way I found when running these workshops for people to think about using that those kind of different methods to think about how things are now in our current space by thinking about things like if this changed, what would it look like? Because we kind of tend to hook onto something that already exists, and then we're limited in our thought already to that thing, like ChatGPT or LLMs or whatever. It's like, okay, well, we have this tool, but then we're already kind of limiting ourselves rather than taking a step back and thinking, okay, what is the kind of a different situation, you know, if we went back in time or if we went to
forward.
The far future.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. So it kind of says a lot about our current mindset, I think.
So is that a particular methodology? Has that got a kind of background to it?
Yeah, I mean, inspired by design fiction originally.
Right.
But that's a little bit, I'm getting the people, it's more, almost like participatory fiction.
Right.
There's a few different names for it.
Okay.
But I'm almost getting people to write their own story. Whereas, yeah, design fiction is it's very similar, but it's more a design tool. Like, the designers tend to create the fictions, and then they kind of, maybe with participation, as a way for the audience to think about a particular product, or even doesn't have to be a product that already exists. It could be a completely new product. So the designer, like, designs something that doesn't exist completely.
Mm.
I'm more using fiction writing and, like, scenarios. So I'm giving them some scenarios.
Right.
So it's very much narrative writing.
Like, yeah.
Their own writing. There's a few different ones. There's one called Story Completion, which is used in psychology, and it's used for things like where things that might be taboo, like sex or the kind of aspects of gender or something, like to kind of get their underlying biases or assumptions. Mm. So it's still using fiction, but it's getting them to write it. And there's not much on actually getting people to write fiction. There's, in the literature, I mean, the academic literature, there is in the world, because we use fiction all the time. But actually getting people to write stories or fiction rather than reading, because there's a lot of reading, people don't really see themselves as story writers. So that's why I like doing it. And people either like it or they don't. And you know, the good thing about these conferences is there's always another option to another workshop to choose from.
Yeah, but I think, I get what you say, that people don't see themselves as writers, but we're all storytellers to some extent. And I think once you get in, one of the reasons why I was looking at design fictions as a methodology was, it was a paper I read for a reading group recently. If you set it up well, and this paper hadn't, but if you get people to tell stories about things, they dig deeper into their ideas, and there's something about that whole process which, almost like autoethnography, when you start telling your own story, you reveal data or you come up with ideas or you remember incidents that you hadn't already thought of. And with design fictions, when you start creating a narrative, you think of alternatives and consequences that you hadn't already thought of. That's, I guess, what you're doing with your...
Yeah.
Oh, man, that's fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, design fiction, I mean, I know I said, design fiction is this, but it doesn't really have a set process.
No.
So each sort of designer has a different way of doing it. So it's quite hard to pin down.
Yeah, what it is. Well, you don't have to, do you? Because you can write your own design fiction about design fictions.
Yeah. When you said design fiction, some people think like, oh, science fiction. But it's like a different thing. And yeah, it kind of changes how you perceive different things when you look at it like that. Yeah, anyway, people come up with some crazy stuff, and it's really fascinating.
Okay, that sounds really good. So really, that's kind of like the whole, fits in really well with the playful learning approach as well, it's a sort of magic circle and you're creating this fictional space and then people can play about with that. And okay, that's really cool. So overall then, any sort of takeaways from the conference or things that you kind of going to take back or...
But it's just good to see the different variety of people and roles here. So
yeah, it's good. No, it has. It's been really good. Yeah, and a core people that I know from other things, but also new people coming and getting involved in it all. Yeah. Mm. So thanks, Neil. That's excellent.
Yeah.
That'll
there
be really good.
Change in education as well. That'll be the other takeaway from talking to people.
Yeah, I mean that. Yeah, there's so many things that sort of that. What was that? So it was Andrew's things on, you know, education, needing all the world being volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous.
Yes.
And I think, education needs to be that as well, because he was talking about VUCA. But to that, I would also add experiential. Mm-hmm. And also, I don't know, one of the things, radical as well, because I think, you know, we can change things and do stuff like the stuff you're doing, which is about rethinking stuff. But also because if you add in E and R, you can have the acronym VERUCA, which I kind of... Possibly ridiculous, but there we go. Anyway, okay, thanks, Neil. We'll end it there. You. And yeah, glad you could pop by to the studio. And yeah, hopefully the rest, well, I'm sure your session will go really well. It sounds really interesting.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Okay. Now, this is actually our fifth podcast. I said the last one was our fifth, but I lost count. So this is the fifth one, and this is with one of the people who have been helping run the conference and sitting on the registration desk all day. And so, do you want to say who you are and what do you do here?
Yeah. Okay, so my name's Ilse Ingham. I'm an events and digital manager here at Northumbria University. So I've been working with Nick for quite a while now, planning the logistical side of the conference rather than the content side.
And I have to say that Ailsa is the only reason there are any podcasts happening here today, because without her getting me a car parking space, I'd have been dragging my equipment halfway across Newcastle. And so, yeah, and I wouldn't have been here in time or anything. So, yeah, so anyway, so this is the person who's probably bringing it all together. So, how's it been going so far?
So far, so good. Everybody seems to be in good spirits, enjoying themselves. Had some nice food in between, which is sort of my side of things. So keeping everybody happy.
And the food is all, is it vegan, vegetarian?
What's all vegan and vegetarian, yeah. Plant-based. Yeah.
So this is what Nick always does because of, it's not from it could be from a whole set of reasons, but it's mainly sustainability and all that sort of thing. Is so her playful learning conferences were all vegan, vegetarian. And she did say in the opening address that nobody's ever complained, but that's not quite true. I think it was the first one I was at, we were in the queue and there was a guy in the queue and he went, "Where's all the meat?" Like a really plaintive, like he was going to not survive the entire day unless he had something that got meat in it. But so there's only one complaint in 5 years or whatever of playful learning. So what does it actually, so you do it for loads of different conferences. What does it actually entail then? Is it sort of finding the space, getting the rooms together, all that sort of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's kind of doing the logistical side of things, finding the spaces, making sure everybody's got like the vision of what their event to be and then making that a reality.
Okay.
And then, so that's like the practical side of things. And then we also help with things like sustainability, trying to get people to have like plant-based catering and things like that. Accessibility, we're really keen on as well. As a university, we've got a really good infrastructure for that. So it's just trying to translate that into events as well as teaching.
And I suppose the vision thing with this, this is a supposedly hybrid conference. This is what the podcasting's partly for, is to support the online side of things. Is that something that's common? Is that something that you had to, yeah, is that happening more and more now then?
Absolutely. The hybrid? I mean, for us, COVID, like everybody else, that was like a huge shift where everything went from all in person to all online. And now we're working with that kind of like, elements of it. I think a lot of people have gone full back in person, but I think it's really nice because it's advanced the technology and our experience of doing online and in person.
Yeah.
And trying to bridge that gap between delegates who are here and not.
Yeah, and that's tricky. We got Matt, who I'm hoping to speak to later, who is sort of chairing all the online stuff and being the online presence in the room. So that he can manage that side of things. But yeah, it's setting up all the tech, and we had a little look around last week and you got introduced me to the tech support people, and I got to look at all their microphones with envy.
The secret room of microphones. Yeah,
a secret room. It's like, oh, he's got Rode Wi-Fi USB microphone. Oh, but all that was really good, yeah. But it is quite a lot smaller, I guess, than usual, because we've got 35, 40 people here. Does that make a difference at all?
I think it's a really good way of, I think you guys have really pushed the boundaries on what you're doing with like having Discord as an element. Which is not usually one of our day-to-day, especially within the events team, what we would use. Yeah. So I think that's been really good. And our tell team are absolutely fantastic. And it's been really interesting. I think having that smaller group means kind of experimenting with different elements and things like that, even the podcast bit in itself, is more manageable, and then you can see how that would work with a bigger audience.
Yeah, and hopefully we can grow it next year. But as Absolutely. Nick said in the intro, it's good that it's one. I like conferences. I used to go to a conference every year in Prague. Ulster alternated with Lisbon, so that was quite good.
Very nice.
Although I do love Newcastle, I have to say that. And that was deliberately only 20 to 25 people, because then you really got to know everybody. And it actually ended up being a more productive community. We developed a book and all that sort of thing, because you get to know everyone, whereas actually with the larger ones, that are, no, not naming names, but Alt is the biggest one I go to. And there's 800 people there, and the chances of actually getting to speak to somebody you don't normally speak to are remote, because everybody can form their little cliques.
Exactly.
Because their entire clique is there, really.
Yeah.
So it is easier, I think, to network at a conference this size. Now, no pressure, but Nick did say you were supposed to say this, but how are we compared to other conferences?
You've all been really, really lovely.
Oh,
it's
that's
been
good.
Really nice, really friendly. And so we've been asking a little bit more information than we usually would at the Reg Desk, trying to get some more information for our carbon footprint in platform. So asking how delegates have travelled here and stuff like that. And everybody's been very friendly, very forthcoming with that information. So that's been excellent.
Oh, that's good.
Very tidy bunch as well, so that always helps.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that being an issue, but I guess some people will leave, you know, their dishes and their cups everywhere, and that just then multiplies the amount of work to do. But yeah, I suppose the how did you get here is about sustainability and all those sorts of things, because I know there's a preference for us to get here by public transport and things, but obviously with all this, that's not possible.
Totally, and I think more than anything in the place that we are now, it's about understanding how people have got there and just having that baseline, and then you can, in future conferences, look to see where the problem areas are and how you can reduce them. It's not about pointing fingers or anything like that,
no,
because everybody has, for example, podcast equipment,
the
reasons for why they've travelled a certain way. And it's just highlighting the areas which there's quick fixes, and then the big problem areas where you think, how could we reduce the carbon footprint?
So you're actually learning all the time from conferences, and because we're talking, you know, in the pedagogy practice about experiential learning and the reflective cycle and all that sort of thing. So after conferences, you have a sort of debrief where you all talk about how it went and what you could learn for next time.
Yeah.
Is that integral with your practice, really?
100%. And we are very much learning. We are at the very beginning of this. So, it's completely new. And it's not just about the data that you collect, but it's how you collect it. Is there a better way? Is there a more efficient way of getting that information?
Also, meta-reflection, reflecting on your reflections. Mm-hmm. So you say it's completely new. What's completely new about... Is this a new building, then? Is this...
So, no, it's actually the system that we use to collect the data. So it's the carbon footprint and element of it, which is new to us.
Right.
So that's the bit that we're kind of learning to get the grasp.
Sure. I mean, it's new for Durham, compared to Durham. Because half of it's kind of medieval. But this is a really nice space for a conference.
We're really lucky here. This is our main kind of conference and space. And it's nice because you can use all of it. You can use separate floors. It works really well. And from a sustainability point of view, we actually have a heat pump on the roof, which helps massively with that as well. So it's a good one for a matter of reason.
And for the online people, it's built around, there's a sort of corridor that goes all the way around a huge atrium. So, and I'm gesturing, which doesn't work for audio, but which really makes it light and airy and all those sorts of things. So even though it's all inside, it does actually have that sort of more lighter, natural light feel to it, which you often don't get with bigger buildings and big conference buildings particularly. Yeah.
It definitely helps with your conference day if you get a bit of sunlight in there.
And so what have you learned? Is there anything you've learned so far? Is it too early to say sort of for feeding back for next time?
So I think at the minute... I'm just looking at the numbers. Mm. So it'll be once we put it all into the system and have a look, and then we can see how that's looking. But a massive one is just having a plant-based
catering. Yeah.
So the fact that that's already in there is a fantastic start.
Sure. So, we're hoping it will be the first of many conferences and we'll be back and all that sort of thing. So
Absolutely.
That's really good. Cool. That's really good. Thank you very much. Okay.
No problem.
Yeah, that's real insight into everything that goes on. Because, you know... you just turn up and you collect your badge and you, well, I know a little bit more because of setting up and planning the podcasting ahead, but normally you just turn up and you forget about all the other stuff that goes on.
Lots going on in the background.
Brilliant. Okay, thank you very much. That's excellent.
Thanks for having
okay.
me.
Okay. Okay, this is going to be a quick one. because Alex has got a session to run in about 8 minutes, so we've got 5 minutes to chat to him. Now, Alex is one of the co-chairs of the conference. Alex, do you want to just say who you are and what you do?
Yeah, thanks, Mark. So I'm Alex Mosley. I'm, as you say, one of the three co-chairs. I'm from Anglia Ruskin University down in Cambridge. And with Nick, the two of us sort of came out of our previous conference, Playful Learning, with a set of concepts, an ethos that we wanted to bring across to a non-playful context, I guess, to apply those kind of principles to, yeah, a more traditional conference idea to see whether we could lift that as an experience.
Because being playful at a Playful Learning conference is one thing, and it's established and it works well and everybody there is into it and stuff, but then how does that work? Right. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I don't know what I was thinking, but I thought, oh, Riddle. You know what I mean? I knew Nick was running it. I knew you were running it. And then it was like, yes, but all those principles will now appear at a different context. And yeah, I don't. Anyway, so how's it been going? Has it actually worked? Has that as an exercise worked?
It's an emerging concept, I think. Sure. I can already start to see some benefits for it. I think. One thing I've noticed already is that I'm sitting there listening to papers that, you know, these papers are based in published papers. They're rigorous pieces of work for colleagues who've been working on these, you know, for a couple of years. They're not things that are just sort of, I've got a nice idea, that sort of thing. So for part of it is we wanted it to be rigorous, so that's definitely there. But from the playful side, I think every single one of those sessions has had something where I felt absolutely involved, which is different perhaps to another conference you might go to where, again, you might have very good, rigorous papers that you're listening to based on good data collection and so on, but you're just sitting there and listening to the process. Every session I've been in today, I think I've felt involved, whether it's through the inner thinking from the team. In one case, I was involved in continuing that data collection because they were collecting data from the people in the room, that sort of thing. So I think that's where I'm starting to see the benefit of this approach, where we're starting to, the community is important, the openness of it is important, as well as the rigor.
Yeah, because I guess the playfulness that's in the sessions bleeds into the time between the sessions. It's a general vibe of everything that's going on. And so therefore everyone's chatting more, everyone feels more relaxed.
Yeah.
And that's the good basis for a community, because I'm guessing, I got the impression from Nick's thing at the start was, this isn't just intended to be a 2-day conference, it's the grounding, a platform for and a community which is around research, digital learning, and about being disruptive and playful and radical and all those sorts of things, really, that is missing from digital learning as a critical and pedagogical exercise up to now.
Yeah, exactly that. And things like the experiments with the online and face-to-face, which is a kind of, a tension and an opportunity that's been there for many, many years, of course, the blended sort of approach. Yeah. How do you run a conference online and face-to-face? Same as teaching online and face-to-face. But using the kind of the griddle, the playful platform that we've got, which is linked to the communication platform. So it's all in the same place. It's in the same place for both online and offline participants. Mm-hmm. So that's a linkage that's bringing that community together quite nicely, actually. And that's becoming quite, again, it's evolving over today. You know, it's people are getting their heads around it. People are starting to solve some of the puzzles. You're starting to hear people talk about it over coffee. Shall we go off and do a puzzle together next break? That kind of thing. So it's starting to, bring people together, I think.
And Nick's thing with the podcast recordings were, No, the prime audience is the Discord channel, which is why they're only 10 minutes long, because it has, you know, it has to be 10 minutes in order to fit on to be uploaded to Discord. Then we can put it on the Pedagodzilla feed as well, but that's a secondary thing to promote more about the conference. But actually, this is mainly, these chats are mainly about linking together the online and the in-person and letting people know the stuff they've missed and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Neil, your colleague down at Anglia Ruskin's a good example of that, because he submitted a paper purely because it was digital learning, and then he saw the guidance to the for the presenters, and I went, oh, okay. And then, of course, it kicks it up a notch, and he gets that much more excited about it because it also is tying in with that playfulness. And that's an interesting... I wouldn't have thought there necessarily be a big overlap between in that Venn diagram, but it seems like... The people who are up for digital learning and being critical discourse around digital learning are also into the playfulness. And whether or not that's just everybody's into playfulness and somehow we've missed it up to now, or maybe it's something, I don't know, that's something to think about, whether or not there is actually. What's the congruity between those two communities just seems to be working.
Yeah, it is impressive. And I still don't think I feel that everybody sort of comes to this event and wants to play or feels like they're a player, as it were. But I think what I've found and what I've found with working with Nick on many of these events that we've run and got involved in is the principles behind it. So the pillars that Nick presented this morning, you know, things like integrity and openness, mischief, those sort of things actually are the things that resonate with people based on their experiences of previous events. Like conferences and so on, and now, I am being
called in, called
to my next
off
session.
To do the next session. Or so we better end it there.
Maybe we should pick this up later on.
Yeah. Mark. Okay. Okay. Right. Thanks, Alex. Okay. Now this is possibly the last one of the day because we're just all getting ready to either disappear off or get ready for the street food bonanza that we've got planned for us. But anyway, so this is my seventh guest of the day, and I'm talking to Susanna. So, Susanna, do you want to tell us who you are, where you're from, what do you do?
Yes. Hello, I'm Susanna Quincy. I'm Vice President Digital and Student Experience at City St George's, University of London. So I'm here from London.
And there's a big, not a huge contingent, but there's a contingent from City St George's, because I think you're the second person I've spoken to from... Was that a conscious decision to bring a whole group of people up, or did you all make your way separately, or what's the story behind that?
I think it was slightly serendipitous, but I think, it shows how we're engaged in the subject area, I think. But yes, we hadn't quite coordinated that we were all coming, as often happens in institutions. Yeah. Although it wasn't a complete surprise, because I think both Jane and I are on the, not the organising committee, but the kind of overall kind of committee about the conference.
And so what was it about this conference in particular that you were interested in, or was it that drew you up here?
So I've known Nick and Alex, the organisers, for a long time, and Jane as well. And so I wanted to support the conference because it's the first one. But also I just really like their ethos in terms of, I've been involved in playful learning before and gone to that conference and really liked it. And they're saying to me, it's going to be like that, but it's going to be research. So I thought, well, that would be great. It'll make the kind of research really come alive. So, yeah, and just for me as well, I often don't get a lot of thinking space and time in the job because you're just so busy. But actually coming to conferences and connecting with the wider community is just hugely helpful in terms of thinking about what you want to do in your own institution.
Yeah, because I was just chatting to Alex just before the plenary, which is why he was late for the plenary, about the whole idea of doing playful conference-type things for playful learning is one thing, but then to take all of that learning, stuff they've learned from conferences and being more open and being more playful and being more mischievous, and applying that to something which isn't by intrinsically those things is a bit of an experiment.
Yeah.
And it's a really good thing to see. And do you think it's been successful? How much of that has really sort of pervaded this conference, do you think?
Yeah, it has. It really has, actually. Just in terms of, I think one of the things that I've really enjoyed about playful learning that I've seen here as well is just how easy, inclusive and friendly the environment is. So sometimes you go to these conferences, you feel a bit nervous about, you know, who you're going to talk to, who you're going to network with, if you need to, like, do things and how it's all going to work. And here it just feels very natural to get involved in games, or you don't have to if you don't want to. Yeah. But the discourse channel's great. Just the whole approach is very friendly. It being quite small, you can sit there on your own with your laptop doing your email if you want to, or you can easily connect with people. And that's, I've really enjoyed that aspect of the conference so far.
And there's a quiet room and there all is. That, which they've also taken from the Playful Learning. Yes. So if you're feeling overwhelmed by it all, and
yes.
Newcastle is only like a 10-minute walk away yes. if you need to take a break.
Yes.
And all of those things are okay for people to do, really, which is nice.
Yes.
And also there's podcasting.
Yes.
So,
hooray.
So what have you taken away from the first day? Is there anything that's sort of stood out? Or well, you don't have to, because then, of course, all the people that you don't mention won't have stood out. But so is there anything particular that you kind of want to talk about now about the first day?
Yeah, it's been a really good day. It's been really interesting. All the sessions that I've been to have given me ideas or connected on various things that we're thinking about in my own institution. I think probably the one that stands out most is the University of Banford one at the end of the day, because I do think, and this is why I kind of believe in the whole kind of playful practice as being really important to universities, and partly why I'm drawn to the conference. And that, because I think if we're going to deal with the crisis that we're dealing with, actually taking a playful approach to it and holding things quite lightly, that's not to say they're not serious crises, but actually sometimes you need to come to them with fresh eyes. That satire approach has been, I think it might save some of my sanity.
And also I find that a little bit of humour about it leavens it just enough to be able to deal with it. I think yes. if you'd sort of yeah. don't approach things with that kind of, well, almost gallows humour, but it becomes very difficult to work your way through because you just get depressed and then you can't deal with it. And yes. so therefore mocking it in a particular way just really helps with that whole process.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's then a route to kind of empathy and compassion, and that enables you to connect with people and so ride some of the difficult situations you're being in, because you approach them with a bit of humour, a bit of compassion, some empathy, and then you're kind of united together in, okay, how can we work through this? It's going to be difficult,
yeah.
but that's what we need to do. I think we can end up being a bit too serious, and then often can really stifle your creativity. And again, we've got to be creative to address what we're dealing with. Gosh, this has got quite heavy at the end of the day, hasn't it? Oh.
Well, that's kind of what playfulness is supposed to encourage as well, theoretically, yeah. hypothetically, is more creativity as well as all the belonging and all the other things. So, yeah so I think it is yeah. a more creative space.
Yeah.
So tomorrow, what are you looking forward to? Tomorrow, are you here for the second
day? I am, yes, yeah. Yeah. So I'm looking forward to. I had to take a couple of work meetings this morning, so tomorrow I've got the whole day engaging, which nice. I'm looking forward to. I'm looking forward to the Banford session, mm-hmm. and I do, after seeing the kind of the research in the background, and just more of the same, really. That real kind of thinking about some of the things that I'm dealing with on a day-to-day basis, you know, AI, digital learning, student engagement, you know, staff skills, all those kind of things, through that research lens and how to apply that, I think will just be really helpful. I'm sure. looking forward to it.
Yeah, and this evening there's a...
street food, apparently.
Yeah.
And a quiz.
Oh, okay, I didn't know about
pub
the quiz. Oh, okay,
yeah.
Pub quiz. Oh, okay, well, yeah. I might be doing more podcasting during that, I don't know.
But podcasts are quiz questions.
And yeah,
sort of, you know,
I just get a bit carried away when we're doing pub quizzes and like, I have to get the answers right. Yeah, so, yeah, so. Well, that's great. Well, hopefully get a chance to chat tomorrow.
Yeah.
But even so, it's really nice to catch up.
Yeah,
I don't think we haven't caught up for quite a while. So, yeah, excellent.
Yeah,
right then.
You.
So I'll let you get off to do, was it shopping?
Yes, I'm going to. So my eldest daughter had her birthday yesterday.
Yeah.
And we're celebrating at the weekend. So I need to pop down and get a few little bits and pieces.
Oh, that's a good place for doing it. Granger yeah. Market, I suggest.
Okay.
And if you can get there. And there's really interesting stalls and things and
lovely.
Oddities and stuff. So,
yeah,
have a look at that.
Thank you. Well, thank you for having me in the podcast.
Oh, well, it's a pleasure.